Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Timber Living Log Cabins. For your perfect workspace, living space or hideaway, timberliving.ie.
Our first interview today is one we recorded earlier. It's with Maria Cahill and it speaks for itself. Maria Cahill, good morning. You're very welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Maria, people will be familiar with aspects of your story. You've written a book now telling the full story and it's called Rough Beast, My Story and the Reality of Sinn Féin. And I should say at this point that some of what we're going to discuss now might not be suitable for younger listeners. For your story, it's very harrowing in parts. It's complex in other parts, but it is very, very compelling throughout. One of the things that is fascinating is the picture you paint of, the only word is weird, the environment you grew up in. So you were born in 1981 in West Belfast. So not a normal place, not normal times. Can you give me a sense of that world you grew up in?
Yeah, well, actually, I mean, I remember sitting with you a number of years ago and trying to describe it then. And I think I kind of minimised it for myself because in many ways, I don't think I appreciated until I sat down to write it just how abnormal it was. You know, I remember saying to you years ago, you know, sure, you know, it was West Belfast and yes, we had helicopters and soldiers, but it wasn't that bad, you know. And in many ways, like my mother and father lived in a slightly more middle class area of West Belfast. Now, in comparison to other middle class areas, it probably wasn't so middle class, but she was a primary school principal. My father was a businessman. So we weren't in that kind of insular enclosed estate, but my grandparents were. So I spent weekdays, Monday to Friday, with my mother's mother, who wouldn't let me outside the front door because she was afraid of something happening. And then I went to my father's mother and father's house at the weekends in Ballymurphy in West Belfast, which was very much an insular kind of self-sufficient community. And I enjoyed it, you know. But we were tripping over British soldiers on the streets. There were helicopters. There were people's houses being raided. You know, I think almost every family in the street, certainly a hell of a number in the estate, had people who were ex-prisoners within their families. My own extended family, you know, some of them were IRA members. My great uncle Joe was the chief of staff at one time of the IRA in the 70s. So I don't think there was really any escape from it, even though within my own immediate family, politics wasn't really discussed very much in the house, you know.
Because people say of you that you came from a Republican family. So what they're talking about there really is your granduncle Joe Cahill mainly, yeah? Mm.
On my father's side of the family, you know, my grandfather was interned three times without charge, Frank. He was very much a community-orientated man, but he was a Republican. And, you know, the entire family, I think it would be fair to say, you know, grew up in an estate where the whole estate, I don't think it was questionable whether anybody really supported the IRA. It was something, you know, post-69 into the 70s that people automatically gravitated towards in that area. Not everybody, but a huge chunk of people did, you know, including some of my father's brothers. And we had family members, you know, my Uncle Tom, for example, was shot during the Provo Sticky feud, you know, the official provisional IRA feud. He survived on a milk float, but he was alleged to have been the finance director of the IRA, for example. So, you know, it was very much a family ingrained within republicanism, and that, you know,
but not a political house.
My immediate family, so my parents, my mother and father, wouldn't have been. But then my mother left to go and study in Manchester teaching, you know, so she kind of escaped most of that. You know, she had the obvious stuff in Turf Lodge. Just to explain for listeners, Turf Lodge would have been more leaning towards the official IRA. Ballymurphy, which is less than a mile away, was a provisional IRA stronghold, you know. So you had all of those kind of intricacies within the community as you were growing up as well.
So that was your normal.
Yeah.
Like a good example of it is your granduncle Joe, mm-hmm. right? Who, you say, was like a surrogate grandfather to you. So obviously a well-known name to people, founding member of the provisional IRA, as you say, former chief of staff, convicted killer, we should say. The relationship you had with him was a really tender one, I think, was it? And you knew on one hand that he was this person?
Well, I found out, I think, towards the end of my primary school years that something was a bit different there. You know, my mother had to sit me down in bed one day and explain to me, because a teacher had asked me, was I related to Joe? And my father has a brother, Joe, as well, you know, who obviously wasn't the Joe Cahill. So I couldn't understand why this person was enthusing about him. You know, they were very excited when I said, I have an Uncle Joe, you know. But remember also, like when I was writing the book, I had to confront a lot of this as well, you know, because I grew up in an area where being a cahill, if you like, was to be part of a unit, something to be respected. You know, people generally would say, which one are you? You know, who do you belong to? And I think that happens in towns all over Ireland. Mm. This was slightly different because of the connection with the IRA. But I had to look back over archive material too. So when I knew Joe, I knew him as someone, obviously we visited him as a child when he was on the run. But he came back to live in Belfast in the late 1990s and he did become a surrogate grandfather figure. You know, I loved him. I still love him. But when I looked back at some of the archive material, I saw a completely different person. You know, even physically, his physical features are completely different from the kind of older man with the, you know, the four pullovers on and the big bespeckled glasses. This was a chiselled, kind of cheekboned, hard-nosed person. And I watched a particular bit of footage where a reporter showed him a newspaper of the murder of a young baby called Angela Gallagher, you know, and he can't look at the, he doesn't want to look at the newspaper. You know, and the reporter's asking him questions about it and he says he takes the IRA word at face value that it wasn't them responsible. Now, they later admitted it. But for that, for me, was a bit of a reality check, I think. I think it allowed me to kind of look at things from a distance as well. You know, obviously I've come on my own journey.
How do you square that in yourself, this man that you loved?
Well, that's how I do it. You know, Joe took choices in life. I took choices in life. There are other members of my family that chose to do different things. And I think it's not really about squaring it, but it is about facing the reality of the fact. And I say in the book, some people, you know, loved him. I loved him myself. Some people absolutely reviled him. And I think, you know, from their standpoint or from their point of view, probably with good reason, you know. And I think it was something that I had to look at nearly on every page of the book, because obviously when you come through an upbringing like that, then I explain it almost like it seeps in through your DNA, this whole essence of republicanism. You know, there's a radicalisation that comes along with it. And I think sometimes people don't confront themselves or their background or where they come from.
You actually, I think, liken it to growing up in a cult, really.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's, people will be very unhappy with that description. But I think when you look back, there isn't really any other way of looking at it. You know, even to the point of when the IRA originally came to me and told me that they needed to see me that night, you know, I would imagine in a normal society, you would probably run in the other direction. I thought I was going to be killed and I still went. And that for me is the, you know, what else is it if it isn't? Yeah, you know, yeah. I think there's an automatic thing and maybe a fear or an automatic assumption that these people are in charge. And, you know, in effect, then they became in charge of my life. So, yeah, I think a cult is probably a fair description, although I know some people will rail against that. And, you know, there used to be a running joke in West Belfast when I was younger where people would have meetings, you know, political meetings, Sinn Féin meetings, and somebody would have an opinion and then everybody else would have the same opinion. And if somebody differed, you know, it was nearly like, what would Jerry do? You know, yeah. You very rarely get dissension on anything from within the Republican movement.
You mentioned about the IRA coming looking for you when you were 18. This is because when you were 16, everything changed for you. So you're a 16-year-old child. What happened to you?
I was abused by a man who was living with my father's sister and he was an IRA member. And he, first of all, a few days before the abuse happened, he sat me down in a room with another individual and he asked me to move guns for the IRA. I refused to move them. But I think looking back retrospectively, that was a very important conversation because, you know, automatically in the back of your head, I knew this man had access or was saying he had access to weaponry. And that formed just another part of the jigsaw puzzle in that automatic reaction where I pretended to be asleep. Then when I woke up a few nights later and was being abused. So, you know.
OK, so it was a framing device almost.
I think so, in a very sick way, probably some method of trying to groom, you know, or certainly a method of control.
How long did this go on for? What kind of effect did it have on you?
I never will be able to pinpoint to the exact time frame nor the exact number of incidents, but I reference it with different events. So I know that it started in late July 1997 and was still continuing past September 98, so over a period of a year.
And what effect did it have on you?
Devastating, right from the very start. And I think everyone who has been abused will know that there is an automatic fright thing that goes on. I describe it like white noise in your head, where I knew instantly, you know, within a millisecond what was happening, but I also took a split-second decision which dictated the rest of my life, and that was to pretend to be asleep because I couldn't confront the reality or the embarrassment, I suppose, of what was happening. And then when it was over and he had gone out of the room and I went, there was a downstairs bathroom and I went in, I took another automatic decision to wash. I wanted to wash him off me, and I think that that cemented really the direction in which things then obviously reoccurred. It had a devastating impact. I mean, leaving aside the Republican involvement in it and an IRA investigation, even trying to get through school, you know, thinking you were damaged goods, knowing that there was something different about you, imagining that you're the only person that this is happening to, not being able to sleep, being almost like I describe it always as being like a rag doll. You know, you were in a position and you stayed in that position until someone, you know, obviously this man moved me. But even after that in school, you're almost like a zombie. You know, you're just automatic pilot, not really living at all, but just existing from day to day. And I took things like, you know, I took K-Pac and different kind of...
K-Pac
was a tablet my grandmother had for some ailment actually in the house, but it gave that kind of floaty feeling at the time. I wouldn't recommend it to anybody, but at that time, you know, some people use all different methods to try and escape. You know, that was one that was available to me that I was able to take it going through my A-level years in school.
Is this kind of what we call depersonalization? It's almost like you do not want to be there, you don't want to feel, and that's all the time in life, not just when the abuse is happening.
Oh, look, I think that was probably a damaging coping mechanism, if you like, in terms of going through day to day. But remember, you know, I had just finished my GCSEs. I just turned 16. So yeah, it was that summer between that and moving into the senior part of school to do your A-levels. So I had these important exams coming up over the next few years, and I was going up into the library in school and falling asleep, you know, with my head on the desk, because I just, escape is probably the best way to describe it. I just didn't want to probably admit to myself that it was happening, you know, and a lot of people talk about abuse happening in the shadows. Mine literally did. And then when daylight came around, there was no real escape in your head, but there was a slight remove. And I think that my coping mechanism was to try to push that at a remove even further, you know.
And it's interesting you say about abuse happening in the shadows, and also abuse thrives, obviously, in secrecy. Mm-hmm. Now, a lot of survivors of sexual abuse in general, we know, can find it hard to report it to the authorities. I think in your case, reporting it to the authorities, which in this case was at that time the RUC, was even more difficult, wasn't it?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, you know, I grew up in a community where people didn't report very many things, and maybe a car accident for insurance purposes, but that was about it. And they had been told, you know, various political leaders had told people at community meetings actually not to report sexual abuse to the RUC, because in their heads they would use it, as they described, for their own militaristic ends. But I also came from a community, and to be fair about it, the RUC didn't really ingratiate themselves either within the community. So there was a twofold thing going on. Obviously, they didn't want to be in police in areas where they felt under threat, or where their families were under threat, or they could be killed. And also from the flip side of things, some of them could be quite brutal at times towards members of the community in which I lived. So that was an added element. But also, I think the first night, I had this tussle going on in my head. You know, my grandmother's house was next door, so I had this fight going on as to, you know, I'll just go into granny's when this is over. And this is me talking to myself in my head throughout this. You know, I'll go in and I'll tell somebody and it'll be okay, or, you know, we'll go and report it or whatever.
And this probably was a partner of a relation of yours.
They actually later married. So, yeah, all of that. I mean, I suppose most incidents of abuse, the abused has some level of mental turmoil over what angle or avenue to take. There was an additional difficulty in that the police were not really accessible. And in fact, you know, anybody can check the public statements from that time. You know, Gerry Adams was referring to the RUC as a quasi-military police force, for example. So you take all of those messages in, and I don't think I would have been entirely safe within the community had I gone and reported it, particularly coming from the family that I came from, mm-hmm. you know.
So you were 18 then when the IRA first summoned you?
Yep.
What happened?
Well, I later found out they had known about it for a year. I didn't know they did. I had disclosed in confidence to three women who I knew. One of those women later told the IRA. The IRA knew then the children were in and out of this house for a good period of a year. They later described it and said that they couldn't morally, their words, come to me until I was 18. Some code that they had. But they came looking for me anyway, took me to a flat in Andersonstown and told me that they had heard that I had alleged abuse against this individual. And my head was racing because I wasn't sure, you know, where they had got this from. And I was told that he had rights as a volunteer, you know, that he was a member of the army and that they were going to investigate it. So I think there's a misconception that I, you know, people think that I reported it to the IRA. I didn't. I had no idea that the IRA had this information, never mind that they were going to do anything about it. And I then found myself caught up in a problem not of my making, but very much became a problem for me.
What would happen at the meetings?
Look, it ranged from, there was a female who kind of softly questioned me about the details of my abuse and, you know, I was embarrassed about this. There was another individual who's now dead who kind of barked things. And then there was a man who was, his job was to oversee this whole, and I'm using inverted commas, investigation. Look, basically it was a kangaroo court that continued for months and months. And that part of me thinks that some of that intention may have been to get me to say, this didn't happen, let's shut it down. You know, that they were kind of maybe trying to prolong it in order to sweep it off their desk.
How long did this go on?
Again, I don't have an indicator for exactly how many meetings, but I have different things that I remember different meetings by. You know, the venue where, you know, where it was, who was there, what the lighting was like, what posters were on the walls, you know. So it started in October, November 1999. There were two investigations. The first one culminated in March 2000, so right through the millennium year into March, when I was then taken into a room to face the man who had abused me, along with three members of the IRA.
Tell me about that meeting then.
I think that was probably the most damaging, the exception of the first one, because the shock of the first meeting, knowing that your life was basically essentially being taken over by the IRA. And, you know, yes, I grew up in a community which was supportive of the IRA. But I think when they come as an entity looking for you, it's a very different ballgame. I was in constant fear that I wasn't going to come back from some of those meetings. So, you know, and I think that probably stayed with me throughout. I was told I couldn't tell anybody about it. So I then had this additional problem in that I was living with this, you know, on top of the abuse in my head. It was a very frightening place to be. But in terms of the confrontation, I had three members. One woman sat on the left-hand side of
you
me.
You call it a confrontation?
Yeah.
You weren't confronting anyone.
But that was their terminology for it, yeah. One of the members, the woman, sat with a notepad and a pen, like she was taking notes of what was happening, because, and I had been told this, so this actually made me watch myself and my own behaviour within that. It caused an additional level of stress. I had been told that they could read body language to see who was telling the truth. So, you know, that sounds absolutely ridiculous now, so many years later, but at the time, that was a very frightening thing for a very vulnerable young woman to hear, particularly when she's being brought in. I remember, because I had pretended to be asleep, you know, I then had to face this man with his eyes open and my eyes open in front of three individuals, one man, two women, who were there as IRA members, and it was an appalling place to be put in and did not have any choice over. And I think that the most despicable thing about all of this is that people have yet to admit that this actually happened. And, I don't think anybody is in any doubt that it did. But the man sat over facing me to the left-hand side. He sat with another individual who sat down and joked about, you know, you better not give off about my smelly feet. Some quip about, you know, his feet to try, I think, in some sick manner to try and lighten the mood. It obviously wasn't going to work. A female sat facing me. There was like a door on the right hand side of me which led off into a kitchen, and behind me then would have been, it was like a corridor with bedrooms and stairs and whatever, an upstairs flat in Andersonstown. And he was basically allowed to, I mean, I can't use the language that he used, but, you know, he effectively told me that I was sick, that I was wired up, that this didn't happen, you know, and he was allowed to then repeatedly tear strips off me. And I got quite angry towards the end of that meeting and was, you know, put out into a bedroom where the two women then came in to me and said, look, he's not going to admit this.
So you were already, because of the abuse, you were taking the K-pack and kind of, you know, sleepwalking through life and everything. This investigation then culminating in that, which, like, and if people didn't know then, we now know that, like, what a bad practice that is to confront you with that person like that.
Yeah.
I think your mental health did begin to deteriorate further at that point.
Completely. And look, probably retrospectively, there was no other way that this was going. You know, yeah. Like I was a complete walking shell. You know, and I think sleepwalking through life is a very apt description. You were just existing. I had managed to shut everything down. And also, just to explain, I later, you know, 2017, I think, got a diagnosis of Asperger's. So I kind of read human cues differently anyway.
Okay.
And now looking back, like, can you imagine how frightening that was for a very young individual to be told that someone would be reading their body language when they already weren't, you know, reading human cues but in the way in which some other people do read them. So I had a very difficult time in trying to work out feelings. You know, that constant knot became actually numb. And I remember saying to a counsellor at the time, and these notes exist, you know, I can't feel anything. This would take me to go to the top of a mountain and for somebody to hit me with a baseball bat. I mean, this was my language to the counsellor to try and describe just how bad I was. And then in subsequent years, you know, I did attempt suicide. I spent a week in a psychiatric unit. You know, drift through life. It was one description. I kind of hurtled through it, if that makes sense, because I just went from one mistake to the next to the next. And I think it took probably until my late 20s and certainly the birth of my child, who now is 13, to get some type of grip on life and actually think, well, you know, this is worth possibly trying to put the pieces back together here, you know.
Before we move on, when a lot of this was going on, you're still going into work for Sinn Féin every day because kind of because this is your world, this is all you know, like, so.
Yeah, and I think there was safety in numbers, you know. So when you were away with one person or two people or three people and they're there as an entity, it's slightly different than being in. I mean, I was working voluntarily in a radio station as well, you know, where there was quite a lot of energy around it and there were people who were good crack and, you know, life goes on. I mean, it's not all doom and gloom 24 hours a day.
Yeah.
You have to learn how to relate to people as well. And I think that I, in a very warped way, felt safer in a bigger environment. And I'm also a political nerd. So, you know, politics for me, I was living and breathing and continue to still do so. You know, I write about politics frequently. So I think I was trying to navigate life in as normal a way as possible in a very, very abnormal situation.
It's extraordinarily complicated for a kid of that age. So much going on there. Okay, so in the end, you did make a complaint to the PSNI. Charges were brought by you and others against your abuser for both sexual abuse and membership of the IRA. Now, those court cases ultimately fell apart. You withdrew from that process. So there was a verdict of not guilty recorded. But we should stress as well, the DPP has since apologised to you for the handling of the case. George Hamilton, he was the chief constable of the PSNI, said that the responsibility for the failing of these cases rests with the criminal justice system, not with Maria or any other victim.
George Hamilton came out, there was an ombudsman, police ombudsman complaint. And significantly, what the police ombudsman found was contemporaneous police intelligence that came in three strands. So CID, which was potentially a human source of intelligence, which would be an informer. So the ombudsman didn't say this, but I've subsequently been able to speak to ex-policemen who were able to decode the murky world of intelligence, if you like. So it came in three strands, CID, Special Branch and the RUC in the year 2000 for a number of months had reports that the individual was alleged to have been abusing children and that the IRA were investigating it. So that intelligence was there all of that time. And if you remember,
it was not acted on.
Not only was it not acted on in the year 2000, it was uncovered during my court case and I knew nothing about it. So at the point when I went public in 2014, I had no idea this intelligence existed. I had an inkling that there was something, but I didn't know what it was. And it wasn't until 2018. So I was hauled over the coals, if you remember, by Republicans online and off who cast doubt on my credibility. And all the while, there was contemporaneous intelligence that actually certainly back up my account for the skeptics and to prove what I was saying to be true, you know, from my position. So George Hamilton's statement came on the back of that, where he apologised for failings within the police. Yeah.
Okay, so 2014 then, when people will remember, you waived your anonymity and you came out and started talking about this. Why did you do that?
I think I felt suffocated by the court process, but I also didn't expect Sinn Féin to deny my experience. As far as I was concerned, everybody knew what had happened to me. And I'm talking about this insular world of West Belfast. It was never in question until the court cases happened, you know, and obviously, yes, people were found not guilty. They denied the charges. When Spotlight and Jennifer O'Leary was the reporter on that programme, when she, her team put questions to the Sinn Féin party and they denied it, at the time I was completely gobsmacked. So there were two reasons, Brenton, in relation to the programme itself. One, I wanted people to be able to see my abuser's face on the television and they could then make an informed choice if their children were ever near. And that was a very personal thing for me because I lived in fear for so many years that I was going to bump into this person, but also because I knew the damage that he had caused or was alleged to have caused, not just to me, but to other individuals. And secondly, I wanted the Republican movement to be accountable for their actions as an entity, as a whole. And I mean both Sinn Féin and the IRA in relation to that, because I felt that the conduct and commentary online when the court cases were going certainly gave me an indicator that, you know, things were not all well. I had to move out of West Belfast. I had to actually move cities. You know, I had a young child at the time. And then I made the decision to do the programme. And I wanted people to know. I was enraged when I saw the Anya Adams case. And I fell apart quite quickly after that.
This
and
is the case about Gerry Adams' niece,
yes,
who was abused
by her father, Liam, who's now dead. Yeah, but you
know,
at that time,
Liam MacDonald and Gerry Adams have both apologised to you.
Well, Mary Lou MacDonald, from her point of view, and its apology, from mine, it isn't, because she apologised for processes not being put in place at the time, and only after the Ombudsman report came out, 4 years after I went public. Remember, so I think I was kicked around quite badly in the public domain by the Sinn Féin party for those 4 years until the Police Ombudsman report came, which they accepted, the Sinn Féin party. Apologising to me for processes is not enough. I want the Sinn Féin party to actually admit, and they've never denied that there was an IRA investigation. I've carefully gone through this in the book. You know, I've looked at the statements. When they're asked directly, they say, "I don't know."
Yeah.
But they prepared briefing notes for their party in relation to how their representatives should answer questions in relation to my case. And one of them was, "Do you believe Maria Cahill?" I don't think that's acceptable, an acceptable way for
now,
any.
Let us say, for Mary Lou MacDonald, and you know this, she has... She believes you. She has said on numerous occasions she believes you. She said what happened to you was awful, hideous, profoundly traumatic. She unreservedly apologises again. That was about procedures. Mm-hmm. Hideous, an awful, awful thing. I absolutely believe it happened.
Well, sorry,
she
Brendan.
Believes you. I think what she says is she does not know what the IRA did at that point. She has no way of knowing it and she has no way of getting that knowledge.
And that's
we'll
the point.
We'll have to accept her bona fides on that.
I'm not saying I don't accept her bona fides on that, but I think that she has a responsibility as the leader of a political party, and that's where she is now. You know, she's in the top job. So I'm not disputing that she has said that she believed I was abused. What I have done in the book is I have forensically, I think, gone through all of the public statements, and people can make their own minds up in this. I think she has a responsibility, given that the people who were involved in my case at the time are still have close links to the Sinn Féin party. And I think, given that she has publicly stated on record that she spoke to one of the individuals, one of the women she says involved, that she has a responsibility to ask people to make themselves accountable. I've made it clear, and I've sat facing her in a room, and I've said, in my opinion, and it is a subjective opinion, that she has abdicated her responsibility as a leader by saying, "Well, I don't want to get involved in that, or I can't get involved in that because I can't give you answers."
But you understand, you know, that she would differ with that, and she would say, "I'm the leader of a as she says, she's the leader of a political party. What happened in the IRA back then is not something that is in her purview."
But the Sinn Féin party, corporately, if we remove Mary Lou MacDonald out of the picture, which she's the figurehead for this particular party, The Sinn Féin party offices were used during my, and I'm using the inverted commas again, IRA investigation. Gerry Adams' personal office was used. Now, he wasn't in it, but Siobhan O'Hanlon was the secretary and opened it to allow IRA members to question me in his own office.
Those meetings happened in that office.
In his office, and also in an office beside what they call the Six County office. So they are corporately tied into this. And for that reason, and that is the reason why I say that as the leader of a political party, if a victim of abuse is telling you that she was questioned by an illegal armed organisation in your party offices in the year 2000, you know, you have a responsibility then to go away and try and do something about that.
This all happened, you originally came out before the Me Too movement happened, and people might not remember, but I guess there was a different kind of atmosphere around these kind of things. Do you think that if you had first come with your story post Me Too, that it would have been all very different?
I think that Republicans as an entity may have been slightly more careful in terms of allowing people to see how they were treating the victim of sexual abuse publicly. And that's as diplomatic as I can be about it. I mean, I wrote in the book that I thought it wouldn't happen, but the book came out, it's publication day, obviously this week, and I'm already seeing tweets going up, kind of repeating that, you know, there's some level of abuse happening as we speak on social media, I would imagine, and there'll be more after this programme. And that's a very difficult place to be as a victim of abuse, but also as a woman who has a 13-year-old daughter. You know, I don't want my child seeing that stuff. I don't want anybody's child seeing that level of behaviour towards any individual online. And,
because that online abuse is still constant, yeah?
Not to the same level that it was at the time, but maybe that will come.
Can I ask you finally, it feels at times here in the book as if what happened to you and the issues it caused you, the effect it had on your mental health and everything, were almost used to gaslight you along the way. We were only trying to help Maria, and Maria's not well and she really needs to look after herself and all that kind of thing. That is now what we would call gaslighting, is it?
Yeah, and I think it probably will continue, you know. I mean, like, and that's the point that I was trying to make. I think if you have an interest in power, any institution, let's not talk about Sinn Féin, let's talk about it in the round, you know, The first thing that any type of institution does is clamp down and try and protect its reputation. And then people like me become collateral damage. And, you know, there are 3,500 victims in Northern Ireland who've been treated as collateral damage, you know, who have suffered much more than I have. So, yes, I think that there is always going to be, and I talked about isolation once you step outside of the cult earlier, I think there's always going to be that element of gaslighting. But I also think that they probably underestimated my stubbornness on this one. You know, I know what happened, so I'm not seeking answers in relation to that. And that makes me slightly different than other people, because I then was doggedly going to pursue it. And I think that one of the phrases that was used about me in terms of me being abused on social media was, hell hath no fury than a woman scorned. And I used to really rail against that because I thought it was unfair. But actually, it's probably true. You know, in terms of, I felt like I was having my face repeatedly slapped every time a public statement was issued. I felt like I was being kicked around like a football. And I was going to curse there, but I'm not going to do it. But, you know, I am not and never was going to just allow that to happen without actually answering for myself back. And I think it's hugely important. As I say, I have a young child. I wouldn't want Ciarla, my daughter, going through any of that, any of those experiences growing up. She's a very different life now than I did. You know, she goes to a Catholic school. She goes to a Protestant Sunday school at the weekends. You know, she's friends from all religions in the north. It was very important to me that she had that type of upbringing, because I think that makes people more rounded individuals in relation to that. And I think, and I wish that some of the Republicans who are still fixated in abusing me would actually move their minds outside of the football that they were kicking and look at the issue in the round, because, you know, it wasn't just me. There were other people who came after me in different circumstances. Paddy McGahan, for example, went public. There have been other cases in the arena, both inside and outside the judicial system. And I think that there is still an element of denial around this that is very damaging for everybody. And the only way that you can actually shine light into the shadows is to confront it.
Okay. Maria Cahill, thank you very much. Rough Beast, My Story and the Reality of Sinn Féin is the book, and it's out now. Thanks, Maria.
Thank you.
Lots of texts coming in during that interview with Maria Cahill. Maria Cahill is unbelievably brave. I hope she finds health and happiness for the rest of her life. A formidable woman, another texter says. Articulate, searingly intelligent, and a survivor. What an amazing, resilient and brave person she truly is, says another texter. It's so harrowing to even listen to the story of her life. And I do always think that we are warning people that that's not suitable for young ears. And it happened to her when she was a 16-year-old girl. It's not even suitable for children to hear. It happened to her. Just read you one last text. This is interesting. Hi, Brendan. What a great interview with Maria. She is so honest and brave. When she refers to coming from a Republican family being like a cult, I come from a Southern Republican family. Her granduncle Joe stayed in our house while on the run. The fear of that being found out as a small child has impacted me throughout my life. There you go. We'll take a break.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.